Hello, this is Simon Mayo. Now, this afternoon, due to an emergency cricket press conference, we didn't hear James King's reviews of the week's new releases. But keep listening for interviews with the organiser of Fright Fest, Alan Jones, and the legendary horror director, Guillermo del Toro. We're also joined by the director of Severance, Christopher Smith, before James King gave us his thoughts on the UK's box office top 10. Back to normal, hopefully, next week.
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
James King, how are you, sir?
I thought you were going to say, how old am I? Yeah, I'm very well, thank you.
Normally when Kermode goes away, he leaves you with a dull old week.
Yeah, well, he's actually changed that. He does normally leave me on the bank holiday weekend, because we do normally speak to the same guy we're going to speak to in a few seconds, if I remember rightly. It always seems to be me in the studio for Alan Jones, who's coming up later. But yes, no, it's a good week this week. He's made a mistake, hasn't he? He'll regret this.
Yes, now, the aforementioned Alan Jones is, of course, amongst many other things, the organiser of Fright Fest, which goes on this weekend in London. Hello, Alan.
Hi there.
How are you?
Oh, worn out, to be honest, already.
Yeah, it's barely started. I was going to say, how can you be worn out and it's just Friday?
Because we had the charity premiere of Severance last night, and it was like a very late night.
Well, we're going to talk to the director, Christopher Smith, in just a few moments' time on that. So just tantalise us and tease us with some highlights of Fright Fest coming up.
Well, of course, we open with what is, without doubt, the fantasy film of the year, which is, of course, Guillermo's Pan's Labyrinth. And we close with, like, the biggest Asian success of all time, which is The Host. I mean, that's doing Star Wars business over in Asia. So we're really pleased to have that. And in between, we've got Adrift, the new open water type picture, Hatchet, a particularly sort of gruesome Friday the 13th film. If you, it's real blood and guts.
Start to finish?
Well, I mean, as I said, Pan's Labyrinth is not that sort of movie, because it's more classy than we're used to. But once from Hatchet onwards, it's the usual blood and gore.
Now, Pan's Labyrinth comes to you courtesy of Guillermo del Toro, who I think is sitting next to Alan. Hello, Guillermo.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Good afternoon to you. Welcome to the UK.
Thank you. I just arrived, literally.
Apparently, and we'll hear some details from James in just a moment, Pan's Labyrinth is a bit classier than what they're used to at Fright Fest. Tell us a bit about your movie, Guillermo.
Well, the movie, in between big Hollywood movies, I like to take a break for myself and go and do smaller Spanish language movies that are much more personal to me. And I, after doing Blade 2 and Hellboy, I took a break to do this movie. It took me about 2.5 years to make it, and it's sort of a very dark fairy tale. Very, very dark. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in Fright Fest.
Yes.
Very dark fairy tale set in an equally dark environment, which is 1944 fascist Spain, post-Civil War Spain.
And so can you just explain a little bit more why you have ended up in Fright Fest? You know, well, because that obviously dictates something about what's happening in this film.
Yeah, I think that the elements of fantasy in the movie are not horror film, but I think Fright Fest also has fantasy films, and I think this film fits there. And the brutality of the movie is quite gruesome, but it's to use it in contrast with the fantasy elements. I mean, this is the clash of two worlds. The world of an 11-year-old girl that dreams of a fantasy world, and the world of post-Civil War repression in fascist Spain. And that clash does have some brutal moments.
And why did you decide to give it that historical setting?
Because the movie is about choice. And it's essentially about the power of choice, even if it's executed by, or especially if it's executed by an 11-year-old kid. And fascism is the removal of that choice. You know, the absolute nullification of personality. You know, and I thought it was very important to show a masculine world of basically destruction and a very feminine world of creation clashing. And all this may sound like a you know, film thesis, but in reality the movie is very emotional, and extremely beautiful and lucid about being a fairy tale. It does not abandon that aspect of the tale.
And is it coincidence that there's a lot being written about the Spanish Civil War at the moment, because it is the anniversary this year?
Well, I think it is totally coincidental. This movie actually forms sort of bookends another movie of mine, which was released here in 2001, called The Devil's Backbone. And it was, again, a Spanish film produced by my company and Pedro Almodóvar's company. And it dealt with the Civil War and a ghost story mingled together to create a very special movie for me.
James, you've seen Pan's Labyrinth.
Loved it. I think brutality is a great word as well. It's one of the most powerful, brilliantly brutal films I've seen for a long time. And brilliantly balancing as well, the social side of Spain that we've talked about, but also this very personal story of a girl on the brink of adolescence and the journey she goes on. But I'm interested actually in the bad guy, if you like, in the film is the stepfather character of this young girl, the captain of the fascist army. Sergi Lopez, I think, is the actor's name, who reminded me, had all that intensity of a Robert De Niro bad guy performance, just utterly scary. Is this guy, I'd never seen him before, is he a well-known Spanish actor? Is he very famous?
He's very famous actually in France, of all places, and you may remember him. I sound like Doug McClure now. You may remember him from Dirty Pretty Things. He played the hotel manager.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was 40 pounds overweight. Now, I'm as a director, I'm a sadist, because I'm a fat guy, right? But every time I meet an actor, I say, you got to lose 50 pounds. And I had Sergi lose all those pounds to make him a sort of a lean, mean guy that is so concerned with his appearance and his exterior. He's a very handsome guy, very neat obsessed. And, you know, Sergi did remind me, coincidentally, I totally coincide with you, many, many times we were saying, that's Robert De Niro.
Guillermo del Toro is here, and Alan Jones is here as well, talking about Fright Fest. And also Christopher, Christopher Smith, who's the director of Severance, which opens this week, and it opens, already been shown at Fright Fest. He's just joined us as well, and the rest of us are just going to look in. Hello, Christopher, how are you?
Very good, thanks, how are you?
How'd it go last night?
It was a dream come true, to be honest.
Why?
Well, it's because it's the real crowd. They're the real deal, those guys. They're the real sort of horror nuts, and if you get their seal of approval, it really is a kind of real kudos.
Alan, what was the reception of Severance? How did it go down?
Well, it was just sensational. I mean, the presentation in the Odeon, I think Chris will agree, was just wonderful. I mean, it looked great. The sound was fantastic. Even Danny Dyer, the star, had to say that it was like the best received the film's been since it's been shown. So we were really happy. I mean, the audience really went for it, Chris, didn't they? They got every moment. They loved everything about it. I mean, it's just a great crowd pleaser, that picture.
How would you describe it, Alan? We'll find out more from Christopher in just a moment, because it's sometimes being written up as a comedy horror, and that sounds wrong, because people will expect it to be a scary movie.
Well, that's the thing, and I always said to Chris, I said, this is what you're going to have to really do on this one, is really balance the comedy with the horror. And you know, he actually did it. It's actually a brilliant, brilliant high wire act, and yet, because in a literally on a turn of a dime, you're actually screaming with, you know, horror, then with laughter. I think it's a brilliant sleight of hand trick he's done there. I'm not just saying it because he's there, but he knows that what I feel about the movie, and I think it really, really works.
Can I ask Christopher and Guillermo as well, how important it is to get the seal of approval of not just Fright Fest but other festivals on the way to sort of general acceptance? Guillermo, first of all, you know, if Pan's Labyrinth goes down fantastically well at Fright Fest, I know it's been received very well at Cannes and so on, does that give it a great push into the mainstream?
Well, the main thing is that it's a movie that is beautifully defined by those two festivals, you know, because this is the first screening of the movie right after Cannes. You know, Alan and I and Fright Fest and I have a relationship that goes back a long way, and I really, when we were doing the act of balancing what was the next festival after Cannes, I said Fright Fest, and it's important because those are the two worlds that this movie lives in, you know, the world that is the poetics and the artful, beautiful stuff that would be represented very much by Cannes, but at the same time the magic and the sincerity and the purity of Fright Fest, you know, the absolutely, I mean, a horror film fan is the most loyal, most brutal, and most sincere type of fan there is.
Christopher, do you go along with that?
Well said for the last. Certainly, they're a complete loyal bunch, but they're also very judgmental. So they'll support you. They'll turn up and see your movie, but they really want you to give them something new, something fresh, and something surprising. I think, and going back to the whole idea of Fright Fest and what Fright Fest does is it gives you that in a nutshell straight away. You know, you can tell, you know, immediately when a film finishes there whether it's played well or whether it hasn't. And it's wonderful.
Because presumably, Alan, that there are sort of part-time horror fans who will go and see the odd thing that might make it into the mainstream, make it into the top five. But the people that you're talking about, the people who are going to be coming to your festival, these are hardcore.
Oh, they're the hardcore fans, definitely, and that's what the programme actually reflects. I mean, I do think there's a lot of films actually on that won't actually be on most people's radar, to be honest with you. Things like Hatchet, for example, The Living and the Dead is another one. I mean, but these films they'll all be knowing about in about 9 months' time. So we do play mainly for the real fanboy, but then that's what we are. That's what our brief is. I mean, and of course, if the general public want to come along and join in, they'll be, you know, welcomed with open arms. I mean, so yeah.
Andrew in Newbury or Andrew Newbury says, Simon, could you tell Guillermo that his masterpiece Espinosa del Diablo is my favourite film? Could you thank him sincerely? So I hope that sounded sincere enough. Guillermo, do you get to make a point of hanging around and talking to the fans afterwards, or do you like to sort of stand at the back and eavesdrop on what people are saying about your film?
I absolutely love it. Horror film fans and in generally fantasy or genre fans are far more articulate than people, than the cliche would tell you. You know, like the Simpsons comic book shop owner. Yes. Cliche. You know, these guys are well read, very articulate, extremely smart. You know, and very ballsy. You know, I really love to talk to them. I hang out with them. I'm gonna be going to Fright Fest again the day after, and probably the day after, and hang out. And frankly, you get from them the absolute honest truth.
Have you seen Severance, Guillermo?
No, I haven't. I'm very curious to see it.
I think, Christopher, I think a private screening is...
Absolutely. Alan, sort it out, Alan.
We've talked about your movie, Christopher, without actually explaining what happens in it. Do you want to just take us on this? It's in Hungary, isn't it? Or it's only filmed in Hungary?
Yeah, it's a group of international weapons dealers that are on a sort of touring Eastern Europe, going to conferences. They decide to go on a team-building weekend, go to the wrong lodge, and, kind of meet a bunch of sadist lunatics, basically, who...
I like it.
who turn their weapons against them, and it's a kind of... and it's a comedy.
I'm in.
Well, it's, you know, and it's like, as Alan said, it is a high wire act. What we do, you can go one way or the other, and it will slip over the edge. It will become too much comedy or too much gore, and it's quite a tricky thing to a balance to pull off. And there's a moment in the movie where there's a kind of hardcore hostile torture scene, and it takes a good while for the audience to start laughing again. Actually, in fact, it takes us blowing a plane out of the sky to get people to sort of laugh again, because it's a real tricky kind of it's a real tricky.
Is there a difference? Sort of moral equation that we enter into? You just described it very, very briefly. It's a bunch of weapons dealers. Mm-hmm. Okay, do we care what happens to weapons dealers? Are there some audiences that will go, well, who cares what happens to them?
Well, that's another thing we worked on a lot in the script with the writer James Moran, is to make sure that you kind of get them. This is what they do, but we don't dwell on it. You know, we sort of breeze over it and say, this, just buy into this conceit. This is what they do, and obviously, we can enjoy when the weapons are turned on them. But I mean, and the thing that works so well, I think, is the way that you actually care for the characters in the film. So,
I think the scariest thing actually that you just said there is a team bonding weekend, which I think are words that strike fear into anyone in employment, in Hungary particularly. Did you pick on that on purpose, or was it just the ideal sort of scenario to have everyone together in a remote location?
Yeah, there's no better team building than having a lot of lunatics chasing after you, trying to kill you, I think.
So, and can you tell us anything about these lunatics in particular?
Well, I tried to be careful not to sort of fall into the sort of criticisms that were thrown at Hostel, which is the idea that if we open up the boundaries of Europe and say, okay, let's treat Eastern Europe like our Midwest in America, and let's set a hillbilly movie there, it kind of ends up appearing racist. You just imply that in the woods of Hungary there are these lunatics. So we gave them a backstory so that this Palisade Company has got a kind of like a finger, you know, its fingers in many pies in the big corporation, and maybe they were in charge of, you know, looking after a prison or some kind of war crimes, and it's all left very vague. So basically, the killers have a, you know, a reason for hating Palisade, the company.
So the lunatics who are doing the chasing, they're sort of more three-dimensional than might have been the case.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're three-dimensional. No. A little bit more than
two-dimensional.
Two-dimensional, yeah.
And Alan, we heard what you thought, and we heard what the crowd thought. What were the was there a moment in the movie where you could tell that everyone, these aficionados that you're talking about, relaxed because they knew that what was happening, you know, was absolutely fine and that they were going to love it?
Well, from the very first frame, to be honest with you, because Chris's masterstroke is actually starting with two naked girls, and I think that if you start off with that, you've got the audience's attention already. To be fair, you mustn't say too much about that, because actually that's apart from the end of the film that's put at the beginning. But no, instantly you could tell.
Right, so the lesson that we've learned there is, if you want to get this audience hooked in, is you start with a couple of scantily clad women.
It's true.
When I was given the script, one of the first things I said, I looked at it, I just said, there's not enough girls in this film. It was all these kind of boring office guys, and there's no fun seeing office guys get killed, I thought, so we just, you know, immediately created this little scene with two girls at the beginning.
And there's James a couple King. Of nods to other horror films as well that aficionados going to get, aren't there?
Absolutely, yeah. We've tried to be kind of referential for the aficionados, but not sort of so the movie becomes kind of bogged down in, look how clever we are, look at this quote. So if you're not like totally into horror, you just watch it as a normal movie. If you get it, you see the quotes, you see the sort of, you know, allusions to Argento and things.
this text says, tell Guillermo, Ian says, hi, Hellboy rocks my socks, and Ron Perlman is the most underused actor in the world.
I agree. I mean, I am the... I live to give Ron Perlman roles.
Once your movie has conquered Fright Fest, when does it get a general release?
It comes out in November here in the UK. It comes out in Spain in October. UK November, France November, and actually the last country where it's going to be released is going to be the US, which comes out at the end of December.
Okay, and what are you working on after that?
I'm going back to give Ron Perlman roles. I'm going to do Hellboy 2 for Universal, Hellboy 2 The Golden Army, which is taking the more sort of folklore fantasy aspects of the comic book that was created by Mike Mignola, and doing the sequel to the first Hellboy on that.
Alan, Fright Fest is obviously a London thing. Are there seats available if people are prepared to make a journey on a train to come and see you this weekend?
Yes. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth, I doubt. You might, if you line up, you might get a return. Doubtful, because this is the one film that everybody is wanting to see. But no, and the host, I think, is pretty much so full up too. But we moved into the bigger auditorium at the Odeon West End solely to be able to offer more seats than last time, because we kept selling out last time. And this time, there are more seats available. So you've got a really good chance of getting into most things.
Alan, nice to have our annual conversation.
Fantastic, thank you, Tom.
And Guillermo, real privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Gracias.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
James King is here for some movie conversation, and we've been talking about Severance because Christopher Smith, its director, is still with us. Should we do the box office top 10? I'm aware that we might get taken over by the cricket, so let's do the top 10 and then we'll talk Severance.
And Christopher might have seen some of these as well.
Oh, yeah, so if you've seen any of these, he does a pithy...
Well, fairly pithy.
Fairly pithy. Yeah. And if you've seen it, then you chip in.
Okay.
All right. All right, ready?
Number 10 is The Breakup.
Which is Jennifer Aniston and Vince Vaughn. I thought actually the dramatic side of it was pretty good, but then they have to throw in some really poor jokes to try and keep, you know, fans of The Wedding Crashers happy as well, which threw it a little bit. If it was a drama, it would have been better, but it's a little bit all over the shop as it is.
Seen it, Chris?
Not seen that one.
Okay. Do you want to? Do you want to see it?
No, not now.
Garfield 2 at 9. It says Carfield here. Garfield 2 at 9.
It's rubbish. Okay. I mean, that's pithy, isn't it?
Yep. Cabia Vida na Kejna.
Yeah, which I haven't... Kank, as it's known, actually, makes it a bit easier to
obviously
say. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen this. This is like the most expensive Bollywood movie ever. I think it had the highest ever opening weekend for a Bollywood movie ever. Got some of the biggest stars from Bollywood in it, like Shahrukh Khan and Rani Mukherjee and people like that. Actually, the reviews have been fairly lukewarm. It's making an absolute shedload of money. But, you know, the rumours are... Well, not the rumours, the reviews are that it's an average Bollywood film.
Miami Vice at 7.
Oh, hang on, we've got a Christopher Smith comment from this.
Chris, yeah. Have seen it, really liked it, actually. I think it's been quite, I would say, unfairly reviewed for what I thought the film was. I thought it was quite a good movie.
I kind of liked it in the end, in the second half, when I could understand it a bit and hear what people were saying. But at first, I honestly sat there and I was like, I don't know what's going on.
It just starts abruptly and kicks off. I actually had, my girlfriend said the same thing, but I actually like the fact it's such a mumble to begin with. It's all mumbling through with
But there are many American movies, actually just any movies from outside of your home base, that sometimes just takes a while to get in the rhythm of speaking from different part of the
world. I'm sure actually it's very authentic for how Miami cops would speak. They have the lingo, they have the words, you know, the dialogue, but it took me a while to get into that.
Nacho Libre at 6.
Which I really liked, thought was very funny.
Nothing.
John Tucker Must Die at 5.
Yeah, which is sort of an average teen movie, to be honest. It's not really that great.
Monster House at 4.
Which I thought was great, actually. I really like this. This is an animation. Robert Zemeckis produced it. He did the Polar Express previously, and it has that sort of Goonies, Gremlins-type feel to it. It's a family film, it's a kid's film, but it has a nice little fairy tale darkness to it as well.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest at 3.
It's Kermo's favourite, isn't it?
He just didn't know where to put himself.
It is nonsense because I liked it, but I liked it because of goodwill, because I think Johnny Depp's great in that role and I like the other people in it, and Bill Nighy is fantastic in whatever he does. And although it doesn't really make sense, and as a script, if you were a script doctor, you look over it and go, well, it's all over the shop. You know, it's absolutely everywhere.
Had you not had enough of Johnny Depp by the end?
By the end, I had. We've got another year till he comes back for Pirates 3. I'll be wanting some more by then. It's not a perfect film, but I liked it purely because of goodwill.
Do you like Pirates, Chris?
I do.
You like the first one?
I did like the first one, actually. But for the same reasons. It's just because it's good fun. It's not because it's any kind of great kind of cinematic masterpiece. No. I've not seen the second one, but I've heard it kind of rambles around in the middle, doesn't it?
It does. It does ramble a lot, and that's people's criticisms of it. But, you know, I'm prepared to watch Johnny Depp doing Captain Jack Sparrow rambling.
Cars at 2?
Which is okay. Quite liked it.
And the number one movie, Snakes on a Plane.
Well, you know, I called Kank the other one. Soap is what people are calling Snakes on a Plane now, just to make it a little bit easier to say. I just thought it was rubbish, to be honest. I know some people think it's a masterpiece of, you know, postmodern marketing and it's rubbish, but I just think it's rubbish.
I can concur with that. I thought it was absolute rubbish. I thought there were so many missed opportunities that would have made it funny, and I actually left 5 minutes from the end, even though, you know, I thought it was terrible.
In fact, someone said to me, right, if you want to see a film that's sort of deliberately bad and tongue-in-cheek, actually has Samuel L. Jackson in it, go and watch Deep Blue Sea, which is the one about sharks.
Absolutely.
And it's sort of knowingly bad, but it has a bit of attitude and some wit to it as well. This is just bad, isn't it? It's just a bad film.
But there's a sequence in Deep Blue Sea where she undresses and steps onto her wetsuit to keep herself out of the electric current of the sea, and it's really obviously ironic. In this movie, you have a sex scene in the toilets where you see two people, you know, exposing themselves. What they should have done is when the window blew out, she should have been holding onto the side of the seats and, you know, exposed
her
that
exactly.
way.
Yeah,
camp kind of ideas that would have made it seem more knowing.
This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
Five Live.
To find out more about Five Live and its sister service, Five Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.